Happy New Year, Worst Foot Forward listeners. It's Barry here, welcoming you to 2024 at the start of our first episode of the year with the brilliant comedian, poker player, gamer, Ken Cheng. In this episode, we're going to talk about the world's worst bet with Ken. What a brilliant episode it was. What a brilliant guest Ken was. You're all in for a treat. But how was your Christmas? How was your New Year? I'm recording this from my hotel room in Melbourne. I spent Christmas in Sydney and the New Year's in Melbourne. I will be back in the UK pretty much as this episode is going live. And Ben and I will be back recording with guests over the next few weeks. Onwards, the podcast churn is never ending. Thank you to those of you who sent messages around Christmas and New Year's telling us where you were listening to the episode and showing us your Spotify Wrapts, which we were part of a few of those, and writing lovely reviews and all sorts. And also, welcome to our new Worst Foot Forward Patreon donor. Thank you, Robert Schlorf. Robert very kindly donated a one-off payment on patreon.com/worstfootforward to help support the show. And we greatly appreciate that, Robert. What a lovely little gift to find in our inbox on New Year's Day. And you're going to be able to get access to all of the bonus content we put on there, including bonus episodes we record with our guests. Six of the Worst, we're calling them, where we ask guests questions like what their worst trip was, their worst meal, their worst date, things like that. We recorded some of that with Ken Cheng. So, Robert, you'll be able to access that. It'll be going live in the next couple of days. And hopefully you enjoy that. And welcome on board Team Patreon. If you want to do that, little New Year's resolution, folks, you know the deal by now. You've listened to podcasts, you know where we send you. It's patreon.com and then /worstfootforward. We are always grateful to people who are in the position to support the show monetarily. And we're grateful to those of you who just support us with your words and recommendations and reviews and all of that. You can support us online on all the usual places. Join the Discord channel. That link is in the pod description. There's our Instagram and Twitter. That's at worstfoot. Find us on Facebook and drop us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you've got any questions, queries, recommendations and the like. I don't know if that there's anything else really that we need to get into right now. I hope you've all had a fantastic holiday season and you're feeling refreshed, renewed, revitalized and looking forward to what we all hope will be a happy, healthy, democracy-filled, peace-filled 2024. And, well, if the world continues to burn around us, hopefully this little schadenfreude bubble bath of trivia, facts, and silliness that we provide every couple of weeks is welcome in your world. So hop on in, enjoy this episode with Ken, and here's to a fabulous year ahead.
Welcome, runners and riders, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and you find us at the prestigious Sand Pit Casino in Las Vegas, Northern Arizona. And oh, what fun we're going to have with some of the classic casino games. First up, we're playing Russian Roulette. Land on red, kill a socialist dissident. Land on black, undermine a Western capitalist democracy. Land on green, dump some oil in the North Sea and start fracking for shale glass. Maybe you want to play a little bit of Snake Eyes. How many vipers can you blind in under a minute? Or last of all, it's time for everyone's favourite, Blackjack, where the croupier starts to cover Jack Black in boot polish from the ankles upwards, and we gamble on when that starts to become problematic. And before we lose all of our Patreon money, and please do top it up at patreon.com/worstfootforward, it's time to introduce my co-host. He is the good going to my long odds, Barry McStay.
Very, very good. I've a very unfortunate history with gambling, not from a personal point of view in one sense, but in the sense that my older brother always asks me for tips when the golf majors come around, because I'm a big golf fan. And in 1999, he asked me who I would tip for him to bet on at that year's Open Championship. And I tipped a little-known Scottish player called Paul Laurie, who was 150-1 that year. And that's the year that even casual sports fans might remember Jean Vandeveld, who had a six-shot lead going into the last round and triple bogeyed the last hole to end up in a playoff, which was won by, sure enough, Paul Laurie, who started the final round 10 shots behind. And did I put money on it? No. My older brother, yes.
Just like to point out at this juncture, this is Van Develd, not yes, Van Derveld. Yes. That guy is a French loser, not like this bunch of Dutch winners. If he'd been a Van Derveld, would he either have done a delightful 17th century painting or been a solid mid-level circuit compere? But what he wouldn't have done... is lost his mind in the water feature. Not the water feature. Golf courses don't have water features.
In the burn. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I have a habit of giving tips to people which turn out to be very good, which I never follow through on myself.
I think the first ever bet I put on was an England match, and I think it was something like Michael Owen to score in England to win 2-0. I think it was a friendly against Argentina. And it was in my first year at university. Bet on it, came in, £180. And then did two more bets which didn't come in, and I was like, I think I'll retire now. And the only other one that I didn't put on, this is the weirdest one, it's when Newcastle, I think when they were managed by Bobby Robson, and we were playing at home to Everton, and we went 1-0 up after about 5 minutes, and I loudly declared to my friends, this is going to end 6-2 to Newcastle, which is a preposterous claim. Yes. And then it ended 6-2 to Newcastle.
Yeah, my only very successful day is my family involved in horse racing, and I went to the Irish Derby weekend at the Curragh Racecourse when I was about 13, and managed to pick three horses that all won that day, mainly because they had the word king in their names, and I just liked the sound of them.
That's delightful. That's the way to make you listen. You either go on like a gut feeling, a silly name, or you do all the hard work. I'm just going to flag this up at the top because there's not that many lols in this, but it's in my brain, so I'm going to say it anyway. I also have a bittersweet relationship with gambling because my brother is a gambling addict, and when he first went to Gamblers Anonymous, I opened with, I'll give you 7-2 that you last under a year, which luckily he took in the right spirit.
Very good.
Delight to say, a decade on, he has not gambled. If you are suffering from gambling problems, get your ass to Gamblers Anonymous. They are absolute legends.
Very good. Or be as successful as our guest.
What a segue.
Our guest this week took a path well trodden by so many before him by studying Dulevian projectile mathematics at Homerton College, University Cambridge, before dropping out to become a professional poker player. A road so well trodden. He was a finalist.
So many of us.
Yeah, so many people. It's actually, you know, the number of people we've had on the show who are actors, writers, podcasters, and Dulevian projectile mathematics dropouts, now current poker players. It just becomes a bit of a cliche.
Are you getting this off of my Wikipedia, by the way?
Parts. I've gone elsewhere as well. He was a finalist in the 2015 BBC New Comedy Awards, an award which reviewer Steve Bennett said he should have won. He is, in many ways, the La La Land of comedy. since then, his credits include writing for the likes of Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, Nevermind the Buzzcocks and the News Quiz, and appearing on Frankie Boyle's New World Order, Alan Partridge's This Time, Comedians Giving Lectures and The Now Show. His own BBC Radio 4 show, Chinese Comedian, won the BBC Audio Drama Award in 2023, when the Beeb finally saw sense and gave the man a prize. In a 2017 Twitter thread, where he criticised every national flag in the world, went viral, including my personal favourite, WTF Ivory Coast, you're just a backwards Ireland, and I dread to think what that looks like. He also regularly plays games with friends of the show Grubby Little Mitts, Ivan Brett and John Gracie on No Rolls Barred, where his chaotic sense of competition comes to the fore. So let's roll the dice and see if he's feeling lucky, punk. It's Ken Chang.
Hi, thanks for having me. That's such a great intro. I've never heard all those things said in a chunk. So.
Yeah, when you put it all together, you've had quite the life.
Yeah, I'll explain to your avian projectile mathematics because it is on my Wikipedia, but it was my flatmate who put that on as vandalism, and it's never been taken off. It doesn't mean anything. I did a comedy set about the phrase two birds, one stone, so they put that on as a joke.
Nice.
No one's ever corrected it. No one ever thought, this isn't a real thing. It's just kind of survived.
And you're not allowed to correct it, obviously. That's not how Wikipedia works.
No, yeah. I don't want to touch that.
I've come into your orbit or vice versa in the last year or two, but I didn't... I was aware of your Twitter thread about the flags long before we met, which is genuinely still, you know, every now and again, Twitter's obviously a burning hellscape now, but every now and again, little moments like that are what made Twitter worthwhile.
That's nice. Yes. Yeah, that was the good times. That was the good times. 2017.
When you would just say Italy or just France, but you've discovered the fill button, things like that. But what's your favourite national flag? We'll get to betting in a second. But
I can't remember which. My memory's so bad for them, but there's some good ones. I like the one with the AK-47 on.
Mozambique.
Mozambique, yes.
Mozambique, yep.
Right. Obviously, Sri Lanka's got the lion with a sword in its hand, so that's pretty cool. Yes.
Yeah, there are a lot of weapons. Yeah. A lot of them have weapons on them. Yeah. I swear one of them just has like a grenade or something.
Is it a grenade or is it like a pineapple that's been defrocked? Not defrocked, deleted. So you defrocked pineapple, is it?
Probably that one, to be honest.
So you genuinely just went, you know, professional poker player. That's the way forward in your life.
Yeah, I started playing when I was 18, 17, in fact, at school. And then people were playing online. It was a great time back then to play online because everyone was getting into it.
Yeah.
And it was on TV all the time. So I just started doing that.
And it's worked out well.
Yeah, worked out all right. Still doing it.
Yeah.
I know a couple of professional gamblers. One of them is someone who is just, you know, they're very, very good at poker. And so they're like, well, I can earn enough in a month by doing this. And they predominantly play online, which they explain is sort of a different game. Because I guess you're going off patterns of behavior rather than any tells in their facial expression. Are you better in real life or better online?
I'm mostly online, yeah. I'm mostly play online, and it doesn't have the body language aspect, but it still has a lot of, yeah, there's still a lot of psychology and strategy to it.
Would you find then that when you play in person that you play differently? Do you find you struggle because there's now that aspect that you're giving away something by yourself?
Yeah, I probably would be worried about giving something away.
That's so interesting. Having spent a weekend recently with Ken at John Gracie mentioned when he was on our podcast that he was running a social deduction Blood in the Clock Tower weekend. Having spent a weekend playing some games with Ken, it's so having watched Ken online is very different to playing in person with the man.
They were very great games though. We played some great games together. Yeah. I don't think I was evil in any games with you. I don't think you were evil either.
No, we were very good boys. Very good boys.
Yeah.
I must also ask as a poker player, a professional poker player, and now on a trivia podcast, that means in the middle of that Venn diagram, or for you, a Ken diagram, is Victoria Corrin Mitchell.
Have I knew you would say that, yeah.
Ever encountered her?
Yes, I have in a few situations. Actually, once playing online many years ago, like over 10 years ago, I played online with her in a game. I've met her a few times at like the BBC Radio 4 Christmas party. Mm-hmm. But I think the main time I interacted with her was she was trying to pilot this quiz show. I'm not sure I'm allowed to talk about it. It doesn't matter because I don't think it got made. they were piloting this quiz show, which was meant to be a mix between poker and quizzing. And obviously they would get her to host it. And I was like, my friend's boyfriend was working on it. And he called me up to see if I wanted to come in for a day and just kind of test run the concept as a contestant. And it wasn't good. It didn't work at all. The idea was you could bet on your answer like it was a poker game. Yeah. So there would be a question, you write down your answer and you would bet on it. But what ended up happening was you would just go all in every time on your answer and just hope other people fold. And if they don't fold, you just kind of, you've either like tripled up or you just stay or you get knocked out. So it's kind of pointless to have the betting aspect.
Oh no. It sounds, it harks back to the 80s and early 90s in the UK where they went, any pub game can also be a quiz show. They made darts and quizzes, darts, snooker and quizzes, yeah.
It worked for all of those.
Not poker.
Not poker. I feel like Victoria Corrin Mitchell, I feel like the reason she's so good at poker and must be so infuriating to play against is that whatever she's doing, she plays against you, she'll just be smiling at you.
She's also great at making connections between four things, which is very useful. In poker. Very useful.
She's so goddamn good at making those connections. So we know that you are good at making connections between 5 to 7 cards when laid out in a Texas Hold'em configuration. But what is it that you're bad at, my friend?
I was thinking of something quite random that I probably would say I might be the worst in the world, which is that I've always been really bad at tearing paper. Like, if you ask me to tear a piece of paper in half, I will just not be able to. It will just go all over the place. I've never worked out how people do it.
Yeah, my husband is a genius at tearing paper. You know what? That's the thing I'm proudest of him for. when I first met the man, that's what made me fall for him. Those sharp edges.
that's
just
a good quality.
He's one of those people who's just very crafty and is able to. Because, you know, I have to, if I want, I need to get the scissors, or I need to do like really sharp folds before I do any tears. But he's just able to take it and rip it without any of that pre-preparation. I don't understand it.
But it will always go like, and I've suddenly just like done a semicircle curve.
Yeah.
Never worked out how.
Can your husband glide through wrapping paper with a pair of scissors on the first go?
Yes, and when we have sex, we just scissor our legs together. You know what? Use the scissors. That's right. I'm married to scissors.
Yeah, just cut in half. Yeah. Cut immediately in half every time.
Cut so sharp.
Lovely.
Got to handle him with care. And never run with him.
but you can't get rock hard, otherwise that'll defeat them. We are this week going to talk about the world's worst bet or wager, and Barry, you are going to start.
I had a look at the sort of stupid novelty bets that betting firms offer now and again. So before Harry and Meghan had their second child, they were taking bets on things like how much would the baby weigh. Presumably, maybe that was the conversation that King Charles and Kate Middleton were having at the time, which has made such a fuss in the latest royal book. And as royal babies aren't born that often, you can also bet on things like what colour hat the Queen would wear to Royal Ascot every year. In 2022, Paddy Power were offering bets for when alien extraterrestrial life would be proven.
So you
can give different dates and, you know, will alien life be proven by 2024, by 2026? you know, Paddy Power are a crafty firm. They've probably got contacts in Area 51. Bet Online were rather grossly offering odds on who the next partners of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard would be during their acrimonious trial. As well as on who Elon Musk's next partner might be. And continuing that cynical approach, they also offer odds on whether Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck will be divorced by 2025.
Oh no! But surely you can't be allowed to get involved with that in any way. Like, you can't, you know, go and seduce Ben or J Lo.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I was about to say all bets are off.
Bets
you
are
probably
off,
are. Yeah. Yeah, probably allowed.
You could.
Yeah.
I guess it's like when boxers throw the fights.
Yes.
I mean, it's not illegal. I don't think. It's just people would be very mad if you did that.
Well, there's a lot of debate in golf at the moment. There's a lot of prop bets, in-play betting, stuff like whether a player will miss a certain putt and stuff. So you do get fans calling out nowadays when players are about to take shots to try and distract them. Yeah, which is, there's very little you can do about that in a way. You could bet on WWE wrestling, despite it all being scripted. Spoiler alert, everybody.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. No, we've done an episode on World's Worst Wrestler. I've had my beef with wrestling before. But yeah, so yeah, you can bet on the outcome of things that are already predetermined. And you can have all of these weird bets if you like the Super Bowl. Whether the national anthem will last more or less than 2 minutes.
That's all about how many sort of trills that the singer puts in the song.
Yeah, in the land of
that's
the free.
Really funny.
Yeah. And
smart.
Will dogs appear in any Super Bowl commercials?
Oh wow!
Yeah. How many commercials will appear during the game? Will a fan run onto the pitch? And which player will dump a bucket of Gatorade on the winning coach? Yeah.
There's so many great bets.
These people have a problem.
Yes. If you're betting on that stuff, you've run out of like joy in other areas of your life, I feel. In 1989, I read this story. There was an anonymous Welsh man who earned one of the biggest payouts in history on a novelty odds bet. He placed, I think it was a £30 bet at cumulative odds of 6,479 to 1 on four unrelated events. Cliff Richard being knighted by the turn of the millennium. U2 staying together, the band U2 staying together past the turn of the millennium, and both the programmes EastEnders and Neighbours staying as part of the BBC programme schedule beyond the year 2000. Yeah. 11 years later, he came back to the betting shop with his threadbare betting slip, asking them to play out his accumulator, £194,400.
That's wild.
Yeah, and that's, you know, wild. I don't know. It, weirdly, in obviously in retrospect, it's very easy, but in retrospect, that seems like a very long odds.
6,400, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess also he has to wait 11 years before it.
Yeah, comes I don't know how healthy. Don't know how healthy he looked. Maybe the betting shop were like, "Well, that man won't live past the millennium." That's the fifth condition of the bet.
How much money did he put on that again to get that?
£30.
Only £30. I mean, it's. Yeah, listen, Kent, you're a professional poker player. Unless your skills leave you, you're grand. Barry, you and me, we are considerably more freelance than Ken, or at least more precipitously freelance. I really need to get a pension organised, or I'm just going to look at the form book for soap operas, likely national treasures, yeah, and see if I can put together an accumulator like that.
Yeah, it's a precipitous time at the moment, though, Ben, what with doctors being cancelled, Holby's gone, Neighbours was off and back on again. Maybe the soap opera game's not as stable as it once was.
Oh, good point.
Also, you two are quite a good and bad band to pick at that point, because bands
come and go.
Come and go all the time. Yeah. It's like,
and to be fair, EastEnders had only been on the air 4 years, I think, in
UK. Oh, wow, that's incredible then.
Yeah, Neighbours had only recently sort of been such a big hit in the UK.
Okay, and that explains it a lot more, because I was thinking it's EastEnders had been on for a while.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I want to talk about the Earl of Barrymore, Richard Barry, who I wrote about. He was a friend of the Prince Regent, the future George IV. His nickname was Hellgate, which gives you a bit of an idea of the sort of man we're dealing with here. He loved the theatre, horse racing, bare-knuckle boxing. In 1788, the newspapers reported a bet between Richard Barry and the Duke of Bedford. He bet that he could produce a man who could eat a live cat.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, my. That is horrible.
Yeah. The details of what the bet were, the money, aren't clear. But what we do know is that 2 weeks later, a man came with Richard Barry to meet the Duke of Bedford, who tore the cat limb from limb and ate every scrap, apparently.
What year was this?
1788.
Yeah. I feel like you could easily find someone who would do that in 1788.
I feel like Richard Barry, being like a hell-raising rake of a Georgian lord, probably had like a cage of men that he'd been slowly feralizing over the course of several years. So he just picked one. But he loved gambling. He, in 1790, he took part in a bet where he would race on foot against a chap called Captain Parkhurst, who was riding on a horse. But it was a 30-yard straight course with a turn around a tree. As they ran it over 4 heats, obviously a horse is not able to turn quite as quickly as men. They ended in a tie. They won 2 heats each.
Oh, that's quite impressive.
Yes, but my favourite bet that he took part in was this one. Richard Barry bet a butcher called Mr. Bullock that he would win a foot race against him. Now, Bullock had come to the Earl of Barry and said, I can take you on. And Richard Barry looked at the man, and well, he was fat, unhealthy, looked unwell. So he accepted the bet. The butcher had two demands. First was that he'd be given a 35-yard head start, and the second, that he'd be allowed to choose the course. And the Earl of Barrymore, as we know, sporting gentleman, said, yeah, fair enough. They picked the date for the race, and they met in Brighton. And the butcher chose his course very carefully indeed. It was to include Black Lion Lane in Brighton and Hove. Black Lion Lane was famous because Charles II, during his escape to France, was apparently carried piggyback along that lane by a fisherman. And it's also, coincidentally, one of the narrowest streets in Britain. So the day of the race, Mr. Bullock was given his head start, and immediately, once he started off, turned into the laneway. And the Earl of Barrymore caught up with him in seconds and discovered that the street is not wide enough for you to pass somebody. And so he just strolled down the lane with Richard Barry stuck behind him, and earned himself a princely payout. I encourage people to look up Black Lion Lane in Brighton. It's a very, very, very narrow lane between two pubs. Classic era of bets like that. In the 1600s, there was an opera manager living in London called John Heidegger. He had the reputation of being the ugliest man in the country.
I've looked at a picture of him. He's got a bit of a carbuncle face, but not appallingly ugly.
Yeah, he's well lined. He'd be a good character actor, is what you'd say. Yeah. Imagine Handel, but someone's drawn loads of lines on his face. That's the face in the portrait that you'll have seen, Ben. Nicknamed Count Ugly by London Society. And appropriately enough, he was the promoter of masquerade balls at the Haymarket Theatre. And one chap called Lord Chesterfield took it upon himself to bet Heidegger that he could find an even uglier person than Heidegger, and Heidegger accepted the bet. And they met up, and Chesterfield had brought with him what was described here as a very grotesque woman who lived in the slums of London, and she had gleefully arranged to meet up with Heidegger, and a crowd gathered to witness the showdown.
Because there was nothing else on.
Yeah, because it was London in the 1600s, yeah.
Like, yeah, I've got a number of bets, which I'm going to talk about, where I'm like, this is good and interesting, but I swear to God, if even one television channel existed, this would not have occurred.
Heidegger stepped forward to meet the woman, removed her hat, placed it on his own head, and that apparently made the woman faint. So, that was enough. I have a couple more before I give you my worst ever bet.
Mm.
Andrei Karpov, he once bet his wife in a game of poker. But it was just big. He thought he was going to win. This was in 2007. He was playing against Sergei Brodov. This is in Russia. And Andrei Karpov lost the hand. And his wife Tatiana was obviously incensed, so she demanded an immediate divorce. Said, it was humiliating. I was utterly ashamed. But as soon as my ex-husband did that, I knew I had to leave him. And when the opponent, Sergei Brodov, came to collect, Tatiana began a relationship with him.
Wow.
And they went on and married. She's now Tatiana Brodov.
Good. Oh, it's a tale as old as time.
Yes. Yeah. Boy meets boy. Boy plays boy in poker game. Boy loses girl in poker game. Other boy wins girl in poker game. She said he was very handsome, charming man, very happy with him, even if he did win me in a poker game. And Casanova, the famed womanizer and gambler and daring doer of more things than just adventure. Casanova was once involved in a bet with an individual who, this guy's trick was he would always win sort of a small profit and then nope out of the rest of the game. And Casanova managed to goad him into a wager where they would have to keep playing without falling asleep. And at some stage during the 42-hour contest.
Yes, please.
Yeah, his opponent apparently drank some melted chocolate to try and keep himself awake, but he did eventually start hallucinating.
Wow.
And passed out face first in a bowl of soup. Casanova's declared the winner.
That'd be gutting if you were hallucinating that you were winning.
Yeah, absolutely. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote the novel The Gambler because he had to pay off his gambling debts.
Like, and allegedly lost everything in one spin of the roulette wheel.
Yeah, he loved roulette, was his whole thing. And he decided that, you know, to pay off the money to a particular debtor, he would sign over the rights to all of his novels for 9 years if he didn't write a new novel that this guy would own the rights to. And he did finish it. Luckily enough, Dostoevsky's wife was one of the first stenographers in Russia, so she did help speed the process along somewhat. And it's about a compulsive gambling. It's about a tutor in the employ of a formerly wealthy Russian general.
Fun.
And Captain Matthew Webb, he's famous as the first man to swim the English Channel without artificial aid. And he did it with despite jellyfish stings and strong currents and all sorts of things. Yeah, he had to sort of buffer for about 5 hours off the coast of France because of the current while he was doing it.
What counts as artificial aid? Do clothes count? So he was full butt naked.
Yeah, he was covered in he was covered in porpoise oil, if you must know, Ken.
Excuse me. So you're telling me he had to wank off a porpoise before?
Yeah, no. Someone else had done it previously, but they were in an inflatable suit, so they didn't count in Matthew Webb's eyes.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he made a lot of money by taking bets about how long he could swim and various things. But in 1881, he moved to America and was running out of cash, so he decided to up the stakes and decided to try and swim across the Whirlpool Rapids at the bottom of Niagara Falls, and wagered $10,000 that he could do it. And July 24th, 1883, he tumbled over the side of a boat to begin his swim and was never seen again. Seems a bit like Edmund Hillary climbing Everest and then going, go on, bet me that I can't climb up the Statue of Liberty with no ropes. That sort of stuff.
I'd love the fact, yeah. I'd love it if Edmund Hillary was actually like that. I was like, go on, bet me, go on.
Yeah, go on. But my world's worst bet comes from 2013, and it's between John Grant and his wife, Nicole. John Grant was a Chicago Bears fan, and Nicole was a Green Bay Packers fan, and their two teams were playing each other, and they were watching in a bar, and, you know, obviously drink had been taken, and apparently they had a bit of a tradition that when the Bears were playing the Packers, they would put a friendly bet on about what the outcome might be. The Bears won 27-20. And so the couple went outside for a smoke, and John called in his bet at that point. He had bet Nicole that whoever lost the bet would have to let the other person taser them. He tasered Nicole 3 times, apparently. He said, "We went outside and proceeded to pay off the bet. I tased her in the behind and the bet was for 3 seconds. The first tasing, she jumped. I mean, right immediately. The police arrived." Now, the story says here that actually it was an unrelated argument about 2 hours later that led to the police being called. But I imagine if your partner has tasered you on the night, it probably leaves a sour taste in the air.
It probably leaves a singed smell in the air rather than a sour taste.
Yeah, it's not going to look good when everything smells of tasering when the police arrive.
Good. She called the police because John wouldn't let her into his truck, which again, given they'd been drinking, is probably not a great reason to call
there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. She told the police when they arrived, "You know, my husband's not letting me in the truck. I'm just trying to get in. That's all I'm asking." And then through conversation, she told the police about the stun gun, and that led to John being arrested for possessing an electronic weapon, which is a felony, apparently, in Wisconsin, without a conceal and carry permit.
Yeah.
So he paid
explained that he only uses it when...
Only use it in a bet.
Listen, it's okay.
It's my betting taser. Which I have along with my Monopoly blunderbuss. he hadn't expected the Bears to win, apparently. John said I'd been fully expecting to get tased that night.
I feel like he would have enjoyed the outcome either way. Someone who makes that kind of bet is like, oh, I hope I get tased. But I don't mind tasering as well.
They said their bet on a later game between the Bears and the Packers, which Green Bay won, was much tamer. Nicole said, "The last Bears-Packers game, December 29th, he lost. So next year, the 2 Bears-Packer games, he has to wear a Packers jersey."
I'm sorry, how is their marriage still going? If my wife was reckless enough to get involved in a bet like that with me, and she lost it, and then she did let me taser her, like, she would either concoct a bet that was so in her favour that she was going to get a chance to taser me back, or she would just be like, "If you want to stay married to me, I get to taser you."
Yeah. There's such Florida man energy, despite this being set in Wisconsin.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Horrible. Well done.
Amazing. I had a few to go between because poker players make absolutely ridiculous bets all the time. Just a few of them. There was a man who, they bet him that he wouldn't get breast implants.
Yes.
And he did. It was like a 100k bet or something.
Wow.
And he just agreed. His name was Brian Zembic, I think. And he made a $100,000 bet that he would have to get breast implants and keep them for a whole year. And he went through it. And I just think that's not that hard in some ways, once you're used to it.
I read about that, and I think it said he kept them for 25 years.
Yeah, I think he did, yeah.
He just liked them. I suppose if you're a poker player, maybe he'd think that would be a distraction for people. If you got really big ones, and he was always resting them on the table.
That's true. It's a new lifestyle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another ridiculous bet a poker player made was, there's a poker player, a very successful one, called Antonio Esfandiari, who is probably one of the top winning players in the world, but one World Series, he had this bet where for every time he walked anywhere, he had to do lunges. He could only move by doing lunges.
Was he basically cosplaying as an improvised comedian from the early 2000s?
Yeah, basically.
John Cleese school of walking.
So he had to do that for 2 whole days to lunge everywhere. No walking, just lunges. And his legs... And actually, it was a terrible bet because as soon as he started doing, he realized your legs just get so tired.
Yeah.
And what ended up being his downfall was not the lunges, but because he didn't want to get up and go to the toilet during a game... what he did, he just urinated in a bottle at the table, and he was banned from that tournament that he was in. He was kicked out of that tournament for just urinating a bottle because he didn't want to lunge. He was so wiped out from the lunges that,
yeah.
He couldn't even go to the toilet for like 5 minutes.
So any winnings he might have won at the tournament, anyway, yeah, it cost him in the end.
I'm fairly sure that the lunging poker player is an opera from the 18th century.
He won the prop bet in the end, but he donated it all to charity because he just made such a fool of himself for that.
Yes.
He just said, I'm just going to donate to charity. It's not worth it.
So prop bet is a term that, just in case people don't know, you suggest a proposition that something will happen. So it's not necessarily a gaming bet. It's more of a, you know, I bet you can't lunge for this day, or that you won't do this or that, this or some of the novelty ones I mentioned at the start.
Another prop bet that happened quite recently, there was this player called Mike McDonald who he had to do 100 basketball free throw shots, and he had to score 90 of them, which is quite high because most free throwers, like the average percentage is probably like 25% or whatever, 30%. The trick was that he could start his 100 at any point over a year, and even if he's done 100, he can start the 100 again. So he just had to do a set of 100 and do 90 of them correctly within that 100. So that was actually quite easy. I think he won that very easily, but his opponent just assumed, oh, most people miss most of their shots, but he could just practice for ages and eventually get good enough to just do 90 in a row at some point.
Yeah, it's the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern bet.
Yeah.
You can't flip 90 heads in a row or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Just eventually he'll do it.
Yeah.
But he won quite a lot. There are a lot of weight loss prop bets. Mm. I think the funnest one is a player called Jamie Staples and his brother. They start off weighing probably like 250 pounds and 100 pounds. I don't know what the conversion of that is, but but they had a prop bet they had to get within the same weight after a year.
How precise did that have to be? Did they get them on like atomic scales, and if they were a few grams out, then that invalidated the bet?
I'll look this up quickly. I think it was...
It feels like a couple of pounds either way, probably feels like.
They had 50 to 1 odds. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's even worse than this. He started at 304 pounds.
Ooh.
And Matt, his brother, started at 134.
Wow.
And they only bet $3,000 to win $150,000.
Gosh.
Think of the healthcare savings that the older brother's going to have. And the healthcare losses the younger brother's going to have.
Yeah, I don't know what your strategy would be to do it. Whether you should just have one of them not bother and the other try and get...
One maintains, and you just the other one. I know, given the breast implant thing earlier on, the other one just decides to go the amputee route.
Yeah, Jamie lost 115 pounds,
wow,
and Matt gained 54 pounds. So pretty impressive by both of them to just change their bodies quite a lot. They both ended on 188.3 pounds. I think they were literally within the 0.1 pounds.
Oh wow. That's so impressive.
Yeah.
188 is not that bad, heavy as well. I mean, it's a little bit overweight, but not...
I guess
not
it was mostly muscle for both of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. Then they could have done the lunging bet. They'd have been so fit.
Yeah. Yeah. They had to reach on the exact day as well.
Oh, no, so they didn't want to get there too early.
Yeah,
had to, like, stay there.
Oh, my God. This is so much effort.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Yeah. Because obviously jockeys in horse racing, they go through so many things to maintain their weights. That's why jockeys have to be small, because horse racing is handicapped by weight and so on. They need to keep their diet so strictly maintained to keep them below a certain weight. And but they're in the world of horse racing. Well, there's a lot of high rolling, fast living people who are like enjoying their wine and steak meals, and then you've got the jockey who's like with their owner, has to have like a lettuce leaf and then go home and sit in a steamer for an hour.
Yeah. It's like Christian Bale must have had a rough time when doing The Machinist.
Yes.
But yeah, the worst bet, I'm not sure who this is a worst one for. I think both of them kind of lose out, but basically this poker player called Richard Larty from 2019, he made a bet that he had to stay in a pitch black room in complete isolation for 30 days. Oh. And the bet was for $100,000. And I think if I was pitched that, I would probably be able to do it, but it would be so boring. It would be so horrible to be in a pitch black room on your own, even though that is a lot of money, just I can't imagine actually going through it.
Yeah, 30 days is, I mean,
it's a long time.
You know, we're all freelancers. We've all had a day where we've stayed in a pitch black room for a day.
But he's not allowed phone. He's not allowed. There's no light. Oh, it's a bathroom as well. It's like a hotel bathroom.
It's a bathroom, so at least he can go.
But there's no. It sounds like there's nothing soft to lie on. It's basically, will you undergo one of the toughest pieces of psychological torture?
Yeah. No TV, no radio, no phone. He would be delivered meals, but at irregular intervals to prevent him from tracking time. He was allowed. I know. I mean, I'd be worried I wouldn't be sleeping at the right time. I'd have no idea of knowing when's a good time to sleep.
Wow. I mean, that is terrifying. The fact that they're going, well, what time are we bringing breakfast today? Midnight.
He would be allowed some comforts, a yoga mat, resistance band, massage ball, and some lavender essential oils, as well as a sugar and salt scrub. That was
great. Oh, yeah, great. A homeopathist is his healthcare professional.
Exactly. Like, oh, I'm being locked up away from all humanity for 30 days. Oh, there better be some essential oils there. I'll be furious that there are no essential oils.
They are essential.
What happened was, after about 2 weeks, the guy who he made a bet with, I think he was getting a bit worried. He said, if you pay me $25,000, we can end the bet and you can come out. And the guy was like, no, definitely not. I've been here for 2 weeks already. I'm not paying to leave now. And then I think after third week, what happened was the guy said, okay, I'll pay you $62,000 to come out right now. And the guy said, yeah. So the guy ended up making $62,000 in the end and didn't have to stay for the whole 30 days. The other guy broke. Yeah, the other guy broke. The guy was like, okay, he's too good at this. Oh, I think he did a lot of yoga and meditation in preparation.
Wise. Imagine knowing that you have that level of mental fortitude.
Yeah. The worst part is if you go in there and think, I can do this, but then you fail after about 10 days, you still lose $100,000 to agree to potentially go in there, have a horrible time, and then come out and lose $100,000. Mind-blowing. Yeah.
I'm going to say that £62,000 is still not enough for that.
Yeah.
There was a bet years ago where a poker player called, I can't remember his name actually, but he was bet that he couldn't stay for 6 weeks in just Iowa.
It was in Des Moines.
Des Moines, Iowa. And he lasted 2 days before he bought out of the bet.
It's because Des Moines doesn't have any casinos in it.
Yeah, exactly. This man, he couldn't even stay in Iowa for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either, but I think he said, I'll go there and play golf. And because there's no casinos, he was like, oh, I need out. 2 days. So yeah. Come to Iowa. But no more than 2 days. That should be their tourist board's slogan.
Whereas this guy can last 30 days in a pitch black bathroom.
So a lot of mine involve incredibly reckless behaviour. Not saying that your two don't, but I'd like to think mine go to a next level. Firstly, I'd like to talk about a chap called Tommy Fitzpatrick, who served in the American Marine Corps during World War II and also the Army in the Korean War, and received a Purple Heart for dedication and service. However, I'm going to say that if he didn't already have PTSD that caused him to do the two wagers that he did, he will have had PTSD afterwards, because he is infamous for taking two separate flights in an aeroplane whilst drunk as a bet.
Oh, no. Flying them. People have all been drunk on planes before.
Yeah. I mean, listen, infamously, Peter Buck, the guitarist from your beloved REM, is not a good flying drunk.
No.
So in 1956, he bet some friends that he could travel from New Jersey to New York in only 15 minutes.
Wow. Just to clarify, this is 50s drunk as well then.
Yeah. This is madmen drunk.
Yeah.
He took a plane from the nearby Teterboro School of Aeronautics that apparently had no security protocols and landed it in front of a bar on St. Nicholas Avenue. He made this flight in the middle of the night and without using radio or lights.
No artificial aids, just porpoise oil.
Yeah, the plane was covered in porpoise oil. That's a lot of porpoises.
That is, yeah. Do you know how hard you have to work to find a horny porpoise at midnight in New Jersey in the 50s?
They'd all been run to ground by McCarthy.
The New York Times referred to the flight as a feat of aeronautics and a fine landing. The New York Police Service referred to it as an illegal flight and fined him $100. Yeah. But amazingly, the plane's owner refused to press charges because presumably he was so impressed by it.
How much did he win for the bet?
Oh, I'm not sure on that. I couldn't find that. If it was more,
$99.
Yeah, $99.
Such a waste.
And a free porpoise.
2 years later, at 1 a.m., he stole another plane from the same airfield and landed on a different street in front of a yeshiva university. So this appeals to me like a Jewish kosher university. And he did this after another bar patron disbelieved his first wager.
Don't believe I wouldn't do it again. You'd imagine that airfield, that flying school, would have a photo of him behind the security desk going, "Do not admit this man."
Surely it must. I like the response of Judge John A. Mullen, who on sentencing him to 6 months in prison said, "Had you been properly jolted the first occasion, it's possible this would not have occurred a second time." And Fitzpatrick's defence was that it was a lousy drink that caused him to attempt the stunt, which I like as an excuse.
My drink was spiked and it caused me to airjack a plane.
Yeah. Next, we're going to talk about a chap called Harry Bensley, referred to in the first line of his Wikipedia entry as an English rake. So you know he's going to be a good man. And he was remembered as the subject of a wager between John Pierpont Morgan, so someone who's appeared on the show before, a very famous American financier, and Hugh Cecil Lowther, the 5th Earl of Longsdale, who, I might be wrong, I feel like he's connected very much to the Longsdale brand in the sporting world. He was a founding member of the National Sporting Club, donated the original Longsdale belts in the boxing championship, and also enjoyed fox hunting, which at the time was a sport. And also a director of Arsenal Football Club, so a fairly esteemed gentleman. One evening, Morgan and Lonsdale were at the National Sporting Club and they were arguing over whether a man could walk around the world without being identified. Harry Bensley heard this bet and went, "All right, I'll take that proposition on your behalf." And the outcome of the exchange was that Lonsdale bet Morgan the sum of £21,000, about £2.5 million now, that Bensley would complete a pedestrian circumnavigation without being recognised. Now, according to his grandson, Jim Beasley, it's not quite accurate. Basically, Bensley had gambled heavily with the two men and put up all his fortune in a previous game and lost, and effectively destitute, this is what he had to do to make up for it.
Wow.
What a forfeit. Here are some of the conditions of the game. I love it. He had to never be identified. He had to walk through the world, but first through 169 British cities and towns in a specific order. And to prove that he visited, he would have to collect a signature from a local prominent resident. After that, he'd begin a tour of 18 countries and have to visit them again in a specified order.
Bensley... Was the order like Argentina, France, Australia, Japan?
Oh, I thought it was going to be alphabetical, like Argentina, Benin, Cambodia. Yeah. he had to finance himself, starting off with just £1 and sell picture cards about himself. He could only take a change of underclothes as baggage. He was to complete the journey wearing an iron mask, wearing 2 kilos. That is an iron mask from a suit of armour.
What?
He was to push a pram for the entire journey. Another man was to accompany him for the full time to make sure that he fulfilled these conditions. And on the journey, he was to find a wife without her seeing his face.
You know that condition that was he wasn't to be recognised?
Yeah.
That guy with the iron mask on pushing the pram and trying to come onto every woman he sees.
It's a very different version of the man in the iron mask, isn't it?
They didn't have the internet, though, so it's not like people would tell their town. They'd have to. Yeah. He'd have to get ahead of the letters.
Does draw some attention, though, I would say.
So he set off on New Year's Day 1908 from Trafalgar Square with the pamphlets and postcards of himself ready to go. He supposedly spent the next 6.5 years on the road. There are tales about his journey. He was apparently arrested in Bexley Heath for selling postcards without a license. And the judge only fined him when he explained the conditions of the bet. Allegedly, he sold a postcard to Edward VII, and Edward asked for his autograph, which Bensley refused to sign because signing his name would reveal his identity. On his way, he supposedly received 200 offers of marriage but accepted none of them. And at one point, an unnamed newspaper promised £1,000 as a reward for the revelation of his identity. There is no documentary evidence that he travelled far outside the British Isles, but it is claimed he got as far as China and Japan.
Right.
According to another tale, and this is reasonably well agreed on, in August 1914, he found himself in Genoa in Italy, claimed to have completed 30,000 miles of the journey, but only having 7 countries on his itinerary. And of course, at that point, World War One kicked off, and he was forced to abandon his journey. And I'd love it if, like, Harry Bensley was like, this is getting intolerable. I am going to get in touch with some Serbian anarchists and get them to shoot an Austrian archduke to end this.
My legs are too tired.
Yeah. And similar to Ken's bet, basically, Morgan heard about that and was like, mate, you've done this for 6 years of your life. The bet is off. Have £6,000 as consolation, which is still something like, you know, £300,000-£400,000 in today's money.
Yeah.
JP Morgan could spare £6,000, I don't
know. Yeah. However, that can't be true because JP Morgan died in 1913. maybe his estate gave it, maybe not. But it was claimed in a book of 2018 that the whole stunt was a hoax. It's hard to know. But he did serve in the army in the war. He came out of the army in 1915 after being severely wounded. He lost his fortune in the Bolshevik Revolution because all of his investments were in Russia. he lived a hell of a long time. He lived all the way to 1956, but worked in very low status jobs. He was a cinema doorman, YMCA warden, and worked during the Second World War as a bomb checker at an ammunition factory.
Sorry, he said he was a cinema doorman and YMCA checker, where he presumably had to sit watching people walk past him. Yes. He chose jobs where he could be sedentary and observe other people having to move around. What a lovely coda to his life.
It's great, isn't it? We've not mentioned the Ig Nobel Prize for a while, and we should mention it. The 2017 Ig Nobel Prize, the winner of the Ig Nobel Prize for Economics was Matthew J. Rockloff and Nancy Greer for their experiments to see how contact with a live crocodile affects a person's willingness to gamble. The study was called Never Smile at a Crocodile. Betting on electronic gaming machines is intensified by reptile-induced arousal. And according...
I'm sorry. There's two different things that came into my head. One is people are playing poker and someone just dumps a croc in the middle of the table and say, I'm in. Or the alternative version I had in my head was when you mentioned the electronic machines, is that there's a row of one-armed bandits, but one of them is a crocodile with its claw out.
Well, no, that's the one-armed bandits are Captain Hook. That's how he got his hook. So according to the summary of it, tourists at the Kurana Saltwater Crocodile Farm in Coowonga, Queensland, including 62 males and 41 females aged 18 to 16, were randomly assigned to play a laptop-simulated electronic gaming machine, like a one-armed bandit, either prior to entry or two, after having held a one-meter-long saltwater crocodile. Gambling behaviour was noted, including the bet size, speed of betting, final payouts and trials, and it was investigated with respect to the participants' assigned arousal condition, problem gambling status, and affective state. At-risk gamblers with few self-reported negative emotions placed higher average bets after having held the crocodile when compared to the control. In contrast, at-risk gamblers with many self-reported negative emotions placed lower average bets at the EGM after having held the crocodile. The result suggests that high arousal can intensify in at-risk players, but only if this feeling state is not perceived as a negative emotion. So, I don't know. I don't know if correlation relates to causation here, but what I'm saying is, Ken, next time you're playing a high-stakes poker game, you bring a little croc and just stroke it on your lap like a Bond villain.
It's such a specific animal to choose. It's not like it was inspired by any actual situation you get in real life. I love it.
Yeah, they did. They tried the study using bears, but the results were inconclusive.
People seem to stop gambling entirely.
Yeah.
Just a brief little thing. Obviously, it'd be unsurprised to know that many crooners and jazz singers of the 50s and 60s were heavily involved in the world of mafia and gambling. Like, obviously, Frank Sinatra, most famously. But Bing Crosby and Bob Hope were once busted in an illegal gambling sting. I like Bing Crosby a lot more than I did before I read this. He was a huge proponent of the legalization of marijuana. Basically said, you know, the classic argument, if alcohol is legal and it has all its problems, surely weed, which has at least equal, if not not less bad problems, should be legal. I think you referred to the fact that he'd smoked a few joints with Louis Armstrong, which is an incredibly cool thing to just drop in a conversation. Yeah. And I'm Bing Crosby. but apparently, in the unsealed FBI files that were looked at by a journalist, there was a gambling den sting in Burbank, California, and approximately 100 patrons, including Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, were permitted to leave. Bing Crosby even recounts drinking with a gangster who had been involved in the St. Valentine's Day massacre and was nearly gunned down when a rival gang came for retribution.
B-I-N-G Hope. Sorry, I just had to get that out of my head. Were they playing bingo? That would have been great.
It would have been absolutely delightful. One last story before my nomination. And we're going to go to World War II and an incredible relationship.
Don't tell me World War II was started by a bet.
Yes.
I have in my hand a piece of paper, Mr. Hitler's betting slip.
But Hitler bet Goebbels he could take over more of Europe than Napoleon in a shorter amount of time.
I bet you won't be in the Sudetenland by summer of 1939.
Can I congratulate everyone here for not doing the really bad jokes that are in my head right now about alternative bets to be involved in World War II? No, this is a bet for the good guys. This is between Dwight D. Eisenhower, who at the time was Supreme Allied Commander, and Montgomery, who was the British general. Now,
they didn't get on. I think we've mentioned on the show. They really didn't. I don't think they were the best of friends. No.
I've got a lot of time for Eisenhower. Obviously, he's not perfect, but he's pretty much the most recent Republican president where I'm like, I can get on board with what you're saying. Because, as we mentioned in the show with Tom Toll, he was very wary of the military-industrial complex.
Mm. Pretty good. Pretty woke. Mm. Pretty based. Yeah. Based Ike.
Woke Ike.
Woke Ike. Yes, Ike's gone woke, everyone.
Yeah. Basically, Montgomery was the opposite of Eisenhower in terms of diplomacy. He had no tact. He was limited diplomacy skills, very overbearing. Churchill famously said he was in defeat unbeatable, in victory unbearable. And when the Allied forces were brought together with the Americans, these two men like clashed immediately and they're on the verge of falling out. What happened was that Montgomery made a bet with a member of Eisenhower's staff. And the president thought that it was just a silly joke, and Montgomery very much made him pay out on it. So the bet was, Montgomery bet a chap called Walter Bedell Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff at Allied Forces headquarters in Tunisia during the operations there. He bet him that he could capture the city of Sfax by mid-April of that year. And Smith replied with what he thought was a joke. He said that if Montgomery succeeded in doing this, Smith would give him his own B-17 Flying Fortress aircraft and a crew to go with it. And The months passed. Smith forgot about his little joke. Montgomery did not. And on April the 10th, he took Sfax, succeeding as he predicted. He immediately sent Smith a message in which he announced that he was ready to, and I quote, claim my winnings. And Smith responded by having a good old laugh and reminding him that it was merely a joke. Montgomery refused to accept this and refused to drop the issue. And this went all the way tonight to Eisenhower, who was absolutely furious. Eisenhower spoke to a chap called Alan Brooke, who was Montgomery's mentor, and said, listen, you need to meet with Montgomery and sort this out. And Brooke met with Montgomery and said, listen, you're a very talented general, but this is crass stupidity. You're angering the head of the Allied forces. Stop this now. Luckily, Eisenhower had enough firepower and nous to go, do you know what? Let the man have his plane. And in the end, Montgomery got his B-17 plane.
Stop it.
Oh, my God.
You're the father of a 5 and a 3-year-old, Ben. Would you cave that easily?
Absolutely not. No.
Please take my wife instead.
Yeah.
So Eisenhower thought that offering the plane, like, Montgomery wouldn't accept it. But the fact that Montgomery did, like, left Eisenhower in an awful state, because the Allied troops desperately needed B-17 planes to bomb
they
targets.
They needed that plane.
Yeah.
So stupid.
They needed that plane. Yeah. The war would have ended 2 years earlier.
And my favourite bit of this is that Montgomery didn't get to keep his winnings for very long, because after all of this anger, these ruined diplomatic relationships, the Flying Fortress crash landed and was written off as too damaged to salvage.
So good. Betty insisted on pulling every hunk of metal and screw and broken glass back to England, because he was so determined to have his winnings.
So determined. It's incredible. Just wonderful. But that's not my nomination. I've just read like a cheeky little one-liner that I do have to tell you about, which is more mad aristocrats. A mason called John Carr was instructed by Marquis of Rockingham to build a folly on his land because of a bet between the Marquis and a friend, who bet that he could drive his horses through the eye of a needle. And so he bet a 46-foot-tall Egyptian-style needle pyramid and then drove his horses through it. And this is all to win a bet of £10, which was less than the cost of building the folly.
Wouldn't it be amazing, great to have that much money?
Wouldn't amazing it be wonderful? But for my bet, I want to tell you about a bet that took place not far from you, Barry, on Blackheath Common. Started in 1815, and this is the beginning of like the Georgians' love of proposition betting. It was an era when people were starting to get a bit more money, a bit more free time. It started the beginning of the golden age of horse racing, when boxing starts to become really big. But the other thing that was really big, sort of before professional athletics, was something called pedestrianism. And this is essentially endurance walking. So in September 1815, a chap called George Wilson took his first step on a 1,000-mile walk around Blackheath Common. And he did this for a chance to win £100, which obviously, those days, an awful lot of money. Huge crowds of people came to watch the Blackheath pedestrian. He walked up to about 751 miles. We'll get to why he didn't get to 1,000 miles in a minute.
I can tell you why he didn't get to 1,000 miles. It's because the fucking geese that cross Blackheath every day in front of the traffic probably stopped him. Anyone who lives in Blackheath will have been sat in a bus which has had to wait while geese, who can fly, walk across the road to the pond.
They are, yeah, Blackheath geese are the only wildlife that could take out the queen swans. For more information on that, you can read Ken's PhD from his time in Cambridge. Now, basically, because, as I said previously, there was nothing else going on in Georgian England, thousands of people turned up to this. So there were booths erected to provide beer and spirits. There were acrobats and rope walkers, fire eaters, ballad singers, dog fights and pony racers. Brothels were brought in from London to the spot, and drunkenness and debauchery were rife upon every part of Blackheath, writes a lawyer who analysed what was going on. At night, the neighbourhood was assailed by shouts of intoxication, and the families in the vicinity disturbed by every species of riot and confusion, all from a man walking.
And he had to keep going. Could he stop to sleep?
Good question. I don't know, but he was basically, he was doing 50 miles a day. He must have had to walk. I don't think it was a non-stop.
A lot of these things, they sort of give you like some of the bets you read about, they give you sort of 5 minutes for a toilet break or a 15-minute rest, a lot of these endurance things. So maybe there was something like that. Even that. The fact that there are people carousing around him and he just has to keep walking past it. They brought in mobile brothels.
Yeah.
That's a country industry that should exist again instead of mobile libraries.
For lonely, horny people, you just go in there and just like there's little red windows and you have to choose. Horrible. Obviously, there were loads of bookmakers then put pitch tents as well and started doing side bets as well. I don't know if it was just side bets on Wilson or side bets on whether any of the tightrope walkers would shag the number of ladies of the night within an hour whilst on the road. I don't know. But it got to the stage to stop him getting interrupted by all the hullabaloo around him. He had to have protectors armed with 10-foot staves, bludgeons, and in one case, a bayonet. And after 750 miles of this walking, he was arrested for a breach of the peace, which I think you can agree is the biggest breach of peace in the history of breaches of the peace.
He was arrested for it.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like that story. Was it this year or last year where someone said they'd left a load of money in a park somewhere in America, and like some sort of viral thing, some YouTuber or something said they were going to give out something in a park, and there was sort of near riots. It was young online people.
Oh, converged. just throwing out money.
Something like that. He's just walking. I'm just walking here.
I mean, my favourite one of those, when I used to be a charity fundraiser on the street, there was a very well-spoken man who looked and sounded like a member of the establishment and would walk around with a megaphone and would do things like stand outside casinos going, come in here and lose all your money, ladies and gentlemen. Come and enjoy all the fun of the fair of the casino, but make sure you don't bet away your pension. Enjoy playing at capitalism's roulette wheel as you lose every single money. Feed your addiction, ladies and gentlemen. Look at these fine gentlemen coming towards me to try and take me off something that is not private property. I'm just talking, ladies and gentlemen. But it would be so mischievous. It was wonderful.
Probably get more people in.
yeah, you're right. It probably would.
Yeah. They should hire that man.
I just looked it up. The YouTuber I was thinking of was called Kai Senat, and in earlier this year, thousands of people gathered in Manhattan's Union Square because he was going to give away PlayStation 5s and streaming computer, live streaming PCs and things like that. And there was footage from the scene showing people hurling objects, throwing punches, scaling structures and pushing over barriers. The police made 65 arrests.
Wow.
Oh, no. And so with Wilson, he said in court, it never reached my apprehension, however, until chastised by your all-powerful authority, that walking alone on the skirt of a wild heath, remote from the ordinary intercourse of the busy throng, was a violation of public morals or a breach of the peace. Which is a beautiful thing to say. That was like the peak of his career. He got sent down and he ended up being imprisoned. This wasn't his only feat of long distance walking. He tried others. He was from my neck of the woods. He's from Newcastle. By 1814, he'd ended up in a debtor's prison, and desperately he took bets from the prisoners. He measured the prison yard and bet them that he could walk 50 miles in 12 hours. He made 2,500 circuits, the full 50 miles, with 4 minutes to spare, and won £3.01. And he tried to do the same 8 years later on the town moor in Newcastle. I'll walk 90 miles in 24 hours. 40,000 people turned up. Again, he made an absolute pittance and walked away in disgust. And in the end, he died penniless.
Wow.
So, not a happy story, but I love the fact that he is basically the father of competitive walking, the most boring athletic event in the Olympics, and he managed to get arrested for a breach of the peace for doing the most boring sporting endeavor ever.
Oh, man. I feel for the dude, because essentially he had walked the distance between, I've just looked up a random pair of cities who were 750 miles apart, Birmingham, Alabama, and Detroit, Michigan. And he still didn't get paid because he didn't do the thousands.
I know. It's heartbreaking, isn't it? Our nominees for the world's worst bet are Barry's of the couple where the husband got to tase the wife and somehow got away with it. Ken's nominee of the man who willingly underwent Guantanamo Bay style hospitality and came out 62 grand richer. And my nominee of the world's most dangerous and edgy stamina walker. Oh, hard to compare, gents. I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think of what I would like to do the least. And in order of the things I would like to do the least, I would say in second place, the thing I would like to do the least is walk 1,000 miles around Blackheath. Wow. I like walking. I like Blackheath. I wouldn't like to do it for 1,000 miles, and especially not for the EGOT. And especially not if I was being distracted by brothels popping up all around me going, look at what you could have won.
Don't forget the geese.
And the geese. Oh, God, yeah. And the porpoise oil. And second place, I think, is tasering my own wife. And I'll level with you. I'm only putting that in second place because if I said that the thing I would like to do the most out of the three is taser my own wife, his spidey senses would go off. But the thing I would like to do least, you literally could not pay me all the money in the world to spend even half a day in a bathroom.
Alone with your own thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. That literally is my life for a good 5-6 hours a day as a self-employed comedian, and I don't like what it comes up with. So that, in a darkened room, I mean, listen,
horrific.
I might come up with an award-winning Edinburgh show, but I doubt it.
You could do that as your Edinburgh show. That's 30 days.
Yeah.
30 days. People just come and look at you.
No, people come and don't look at me. That's the whole point, because it'd be a darkened room.
Oh, yeah, true.
Do the David Blaine approach to Edinburgh.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, it's time for the world's best news of the week. This is news from about 6 weeks ago, which I don't think we've talked about, but it's warm and it's delightful and it's environmentally friendly, and I dare you both not to snigger. Beavers are being reintroduced into London. They are being helped to rewild London. They are being reintroduced into Ealing's Paradise Fields as a family of 5 Eurasian beavers known as environmental engineers because of the excellent effect all of their chomping on trees has, are being reintroduced there to help rewild bits of the world and improve carbon capture and all that sort of jazz. It's just lovely. It's just very, very happy-making. It's hoped that they can protect local infrastructure, particularly because Paradise Field often floods, and it's hoped that their damming will do that. There was a river otter beaver trial in Devon, not like the horse trials where the beavers like, were having to jump over.
I thought you meant like the Rainhill trials where they tested Stevenson's rocket to find which train would be the best train, which animal would be best to reintroduce to Ealing. Would it be the otters? Will it be the beavers?
No.
who can stand up to the London rats?
it was actually like Stalin's show trials where all of the otters and beavers who couldn't prove their environmental credentials were put on trial and then sent to Siberia. Where actually the beavers were like, this is absolutely fine. We've got the pen on this. So yeah, I'm just delighted by that. Always love a good beaver story. It's good news.
Just also love the sound of beavers, London. London, beavers.
Before we go, Ken, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Oh, probably the thing coming up is my new Radio 4 series is coming out on the 14th of December. So we'll be probably out by the time this is out.
Yeah.
My BBC Radio 4 series called I Can School You will be out on BBC Sounds. So you can check that out. Yeah, that's probably the main thing. Find me on Twitter and Insta and everything at Ken Cheng Comedy.
Smashing stuff. And we're all off to put Paddy McGuinness and Joe Rogan in a darkened bathroom for 30 days. We might bet on it. We might not. Bye.
That's definitely a case of no likey, no lighty.
Yes. Very good.